This is the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. Welcome to our end of 2015 review show. I met with Matt Singh and Rob Vance earlier today, and we discussed all things 2015 and also looked forward to 2016 too. And the show took 90 minutes to record. As you can imagine, there was a lot to discuss. And having thought about it a little bit and consulted some people on Twitter, I thought, you know, doing a poll might be quite a good idea. I've eventually settled on splitting the episode into two parts. So what you've got in this podcast is a sort of 45-minute episode looking back at 2015. And then next week, I believe, we'll be posting the second half of the conversation, which looks forward to 2016. So this episode looks back at the general election, of course, but specifically how the polling influenced the result there and, you know, what happened with the opinion polls and, you know, maybe what's behind that. And Matt's done a lot of work on this, and he was one of the people that called the impending polling disaster before it happened. So I was very keen to get his views on that. I also sort of talk a bit about why I think the biggest story this year is what's going on in Scotland, and how the SNP's rise there, wiping out Labour, but pretty much all comers really, has, you know, fundamentally altered the boundaries of British politics for the foreseeable future. So we talk about that, and we also talk about the sort of rise of Jeremy Corbyn and the state of the Labour Party as we move into 2016. And that's obviously been a topic that we've discussed several times on this podcast, but you can't really do a review of 2015 without talking about Jeremy Corbyn. And, you know, we were also sort of talked a bit about what we see the future being for Labour there. Certainly feels like that the moderates are floundering a little bit, and you know, Jeremy Corbyn's very much in a strong position, given that the members back him, and the Oldham by-election was very much went in his favour and the Labour Party's favour. So what you're about to hear are some of those topics that we've discussed in more detail. And I started off by talking to Matt about the polling disaster and what he's learned from the research that he's done.
It's always difficult with a review of the year show to know where to begin, because obviously there's so much that's happened. But I suppose let's start with the general election. I guess, as anyone that's listening to this podcast knows, it really didn't go the way people expected it to. Matt, you were obviously the person that sort of saw this coming, if you like, with the polling disaster. I mean, what did you, other than being personally vindicated, what did you learn from that whole thing?
From the case of the election, I think the biggest takeaway, and this goes for all observers, is that we've kind of gone from one extreme to the other in terms of perceptions of polling. Before the election, a lot of people were thinking in terms of the problems in 1992 were fixed in 1993, and this kind of stuff just doesn't happen anymore. And then shortly afterwards, we went to a situation where people were talking about polling as if it were broken, as if it didn't tell us anything. Both of those attitudes are wrong and not helpful. I think it's what we need is more of a sort of a happy medium, and I think that's probably my biggest takeaway from the whole episode.
Because it seems like the early indications from pollsters are, you know, there's different sort of solutions being proposed. I think Comrades have their kind of turnout model. I think Surveyvation have largely said it was a late swing.
Yeah.
And YouGov have talked about, you know, the engagement of people on panels. I mean, what do you think? I mean, it can't be all of those answers, because obviously Surveyvation have almost left it alone, and other people are changing things. But Where do you see this going, as obviously the polling inquiry will happen in January?
Yeah, I think the big caveat we need to put on at this stage is that where pollsters have come up with solutions, in almost all cases they've caveated it as an interim solution. So it's not all of these things are subject to change. But I've had a careful look at the data from the BES, from the original polling, from the looking at the constituency results, and it looks, I mean, the key thing that pops out to me is that it almost went unquestioned during the last parliament that the major flows that you had in England and Wales, you had the collapse of the Lib Dems and the surge of UKIP, and it was almost unquestioned that the Lib Dems were going disproportionately to Labour and less to the Conservatives, and that the UKIP vote was coming more from the Conservatives and less from Labour. Now, based on the constituency results and the British election study, the face-to-face probability survey, so where they go back and spend several months and an enormous amount of money to get a really representative sample. It's clear and got the right results. Mm-hmm. It's clear from that the flows of voters between the parties were much, much more even. So the Lib Dems were going slightly more to Labour than to the Conservatives, but only narrowly. And likewise, UKIP was hurting Labour in the way that Labour people on the ground were suggesting, and the stuff from Ian Warren and Marcus Roberts and others were suggesting, but the polls hadn't really picked up. In terms of the underlying cause for that, it does seem as though it's primarily, I'm probably more towards the YouGov explanation on this, it's to do with unrepresentative or imbalanced samples. So the kind of people that are more likely to take polls are more likely to be politically engaged. Mm-hmm. And what seemed to be happening there is that you had a lot more of the people with, shall I say, an axe to grind, perhaps, who had made people who had voted Lib Dem in 2010 and switched to Labour, or people who had voted Conservative in 2010, some cases for the first time, but nevertheless, these things are passed vote weighted. So people voted Conservative in 2010 and then switched to UKIP. Those kind of voters were overrepresented in the polls.
Mm-hmm. And the key stat there is that politically interested, the more politically interested 2010 Lib Dems broke for Labour,
yes,
and the less politically interested Lib Dems broke for the Conservatives.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So if you've got an overly politically engaged sample of Lib Dems, it's going to skew Labour, which is exactly, yes, the kind of result that we saw.
Yeah, and the flip side to that, of course, is that the less politically engaged, the sort of people who are less likely to join an online panel, less likely to pick up the phone to a telephone pollster, and also less likely to vote in council elections or European elections, but do vote in general elections. In 2010 and 2015, they voted Conservative by quite a margin. And those people were the ones that were underrepresented in polls.
But it feels like, I mean, given the state of flux that the party alignment is in at the moment, I mean, we've seen, obviously, the rise of UKIP, S&P in Scotland, although the pollsters got that pretty much right.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking, like, you know, when you look at the Labour Party, obviously, the nature of that vote has changed quite a bit, hasn't it, in terms, yeah, of, you know, Lib Dem switches to an extent, Greens, and then, obviously, the makeup of the membership is probably less relevant to opinion polls.
Yeah.
I mean, how difficult is it going to be for pollsters to actually call the next election correctly? Because this flux doesn't seem to be going away, and I suppose it's reasonable to assume that If the pollsters have struggled to get that right last time, why should we think they'll get it right next time?
Well, I think what it goes to is the core of the... I mean, obviously, the big picture is that they got it wrong. But in terms of what specifically they got wrong, in terms of the unrepresentative samples and the overrepresentation of the more politically engaged people, that's the underlying problem. So the solution really has to attack that. Rather than coming out with, I mean, there's all sorts of, I mean, Anthony Wells was saying on his site shortly after the election, there's all sorts of ways you can get the polls to show a 6.5-point Tory lead. But getting to the underlying problem and fixing that is what's going to be the most effective in the longer term.
Yeah, because ultimately, getting a 6.7-point lead for May is fine.
Yep.
It's about 2020 now, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, that seems to be obviously the main thing. I mean, Rob, it seems to me that, like, you know, do the pollsters bear some responsibility for the way the general election turned out? Because, you know, obviously we talked about the polls being wrong, in inverted commas, for the actual horse race on the result, but didn't the polls pretty much dominate how the campaign was shaped? I mean, this whole thing around the sort of Labour-SNP deal or no deal, and maybe if the polls had shown the Tories 6 points ahead going into the short campaign, would there have potentially been more focus on the Conservatives' spending plans? I guess, you know, do you think the pollsters bear some responsibility in shaping how it all played out?
Perhaps, but I think the campaigns themselves have quite a lot of responsibility for these things. I mean, I think fundamentally, journalists, particularly given that the polls weren't showing much movement
in a sense that other epiphenomena actually became much more important than the polling, in a sense, in terms of what was driving things. The reality was there wasn't that much of interest during the campaign. I mean, if you think back, you know, if we think back, I can think of more events of interest and of media interest in the 2010 campaign than in the 2015 campaign. If we think about, you know, Duffy, I mean, even like going back to 2005, you know, John Prescott punching a voter, you know, but like there weren't these media spectacles, I think, in the same way. The debates were boring as anything, and there weren't that sort of drama or that sort of big chaos kind of things, with possibly the exception of the Edstone, which we can perhaps put to one side in a garage somewhere. But I think the reality is, you know, a media narrative is going to look for whatever it can get its hands on. I think there was always going to be, because it's just the maths of the situation, there was always going to be a look at what was going to happen in a hung parliament. The polling made it look more likely than perhaps it ever really was. But at the same time, you know, I seem to remember Labour going on about spending plans quite a lot. I think, if anything, you know, the one cut-through media thing was, and this has been written about a fair bit, was actually when Fallon came out and said that Ed Miliband was a security threat. But that came out at the one point when actually Labour were, in a sense, in command of the narrative. They were focusing very, very heavily on the Tories about various issues that were seeming to, like, gain quite a bit of traction.
Non-doms was a particular
non-doms was a big thing. But also the spending, I mean, the sort of 20 billion of unfunded, or 12 billion of unfunded cuts and so on, which obviously we talked about how that unwound for Osborne later on in the year. But I don't really buy the idea that the pollsters are solely responsible for the, certainly not held, but like anywhere near the majority.
Does David Cameron say he's not standing again if he's 6 points ahead in the polls?
Well, we don't know, I suppose.
Well, supposedly, if you believe, you know, that he did know that he was ahead in the polls, but I don't really buy that either. If I'm honest, I think he probably would have said that he was going to stand down. I think he had made a judgment that it was better for him to do that. In a sense, it's better to, in a sense, choose the timing of your going than to be forced out by the Young Turks, given he'd seen what had happened to Blair in his third term and how challenging that had been. So I don't really think that the polling played that big a role. I think the question of what you do about the polling is really tough. And a lot of this comes down to something that we've talked about before, which is actually just cost. You know, as Matt pointed out, you can do fantastically representative, even in terms of, you know, different levels of political engagement and, you know, different social groups and even age groups and so on. I mean, if the challenge is not having enough 70-year-olds, not having enough politically disengaged young people who are actually going to go and vote and so on, then there are various things that you can do with that. If you have a really, really short, simple survey that probably doesn't include all of the accoutrements that, you know, newspaper people like to have in order to be able to demonstrate that, you know, people that are voting for David Cameron also prefer Top Gear or whatever else it is. If you're doing it in a mixed methodology, and as I think Ben Page at Mori has said many times, you know, if you pay us enough money, we will sit outside people's houses and wait for them to come home in order to do stuff. But the reality is that nobody wants to pay for that. And so, you know, almost necessarily polling is a shortcut. Polling has to depend on those shortcuts, and as Wales pointed out, you know, it's which shortcuts you choose which are the important ones. The interesting thing is that if you do, one of Wales's solutions is to, in effect, do it rather than doing a representative sample of the country as a whole, which is, as we discussed, is going to potentially be very, very expensive and in some ways wasteful, because you need to interview people that aren't going to vote and they're almost necessarily going to be very, very hard to find and to talk to. If you do a representative thing of the people who are likely to vote, you've got a classic two-ball problem, because, you know, propensity to vote does vary from election to election and from person to person at different points in time. So you have a real problem if you sort of, in a sense, if you base the 2020 sampling frame on who you think, based on the 2015 election, is likely to vote, you have a you have real potential to make the same mistake again, just a different one.
Yeah, one of the phenomena I'm interested in is, which I think we're seeing, I mean, Robin, you'll notice this, I'm sure, in the market, in market research industry more generally, is this sense that clients are more inclined to bring their own use their own data sources and bring things in house, and that's something we've seen with Sky, with Harry Carr, who was obviously on this podcast few months ago, and they're doing their own polling of their subscribers. We'll get some views on that in a moment, but I just wonder whether I'd also like to get your guys' views on whether or not how much we should really focus on VI, because there seems to be an obsession, quite understandably, about what the voting intention is going to be. Tell us what's going to happen. And one of the things that Harry mentioned, which I thought was interesting, is that he sort of rebutted a little bit this Lord Ashcroft mantra of it's a poll's a snapshot, not a prediction, by saying, well, actually, it is a bit of a prediction because you get your 2,000 sample and you manipulate it in a... Manipulate sounds like cynical, but you manipulate it in a certain way to get...
You do stuff to it to make it look more like...
What you think is representative of the situation. Of course, now, Lord Ashcroft's point is still valid. It's a snapshot of that moment in time, is what he's saying. But I suppose maybe we're underestimating what just how predictive it is because you're trying to artificially take what people have told you and turn that into what a voting public actually looks like in a hypothetical scenario. So I want to get your views on that, but also I just wonder whether actually moving forward we should be looking more at the underlying fundamentals, as I think Peter Kellner called them, you know, economic trust, leadership ratings. And yeah, we all want to know the answer, don't we, in terms of voting intention and who's X points ahead and Y points behind. But actually, perhaps it's more relevant that we look at, for example, Jeremy Corbyn's leadership rating or trust in John McDonnell on the economy. Yeah. I mean, Matt, what do you think about some of those points? I mean, it seems like your VI is a little bit of a prediction, not just a snapshot, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the value of VI, I mean, the thing that needs to be reiterated in terms of VI is that it's the thing that sets political polling apart from other sorts of survey research, in the sense that you, or most other sources, in that you have a real-world benchmark in terms of the election result against which to judge it. So we know this time that there was a significant difference between the polls and the result. If we didn't have VI, we wouldn't know that. So I think there's certainly value in it. In terms of prediction versus snapshot, I mean, I agree with you. I tend to interpret that more in the sort of the point in time sense. And it does have known biases. We know that, for example, that governments, particularly Tory governments, tend to do worse in midterm in polling, and oppositions tend to do better. So we need to treat it as a snapshot that is in some ways, you can say manipulated or... whatever term you want to use, but it's an attempt to reflect reality based on assumptions about things, some of which are in the future. In terms of the going back to what you were saying before about the possible solution of trying to get a representative sample of voters rather than the population, in a way that is, you know, there's a lot to be said for that, especially in terms of efficiency and the fact that you're going after the right people. The two potential problems is that if you get a situation where you get massively high turnout, so a Scottish referendum situation, or I mean maybe 2008 in the US, that sort of situation, you potentially got a problem there. The other thing is that pollsters will still wait by demographics and other information other than past voting. Now we know the demographics of the population, but we don't know, in this country, we don't know the demographics of the people that voted, because whereas, say, in the US you have nationally representative or state representative exit polls that not just get how did you vote, but also the demographics of all the people involved. Here we have a very good exit poll, but one that is solely concerned with seat projection, so how did you vote, and only in marginal seats. So I think there is a strengthening case for a nationally representative exit poll with demographic and other information. Of course it would be hugely expensive, but the value to the polling industry might well exceed the cost of obtaining it, and also not just the polling industry, you know, humanity, man. And also the broadcast, give the broadcasters something to talk about besides asking MPs to make very bad predictions about polls accuracy.
But, I mean, I think just picking up your points from earlier about like the alternatives to VI and sort of thinking about this from a sort of perhaps more of a media perspective than a sort of technical one. I mean, I think even if VI is wrong, and we know that there is a challenge in terms of looking at voting intention and getting that right, all of the most interesting analysis from my perspective that's come out since the election from Matt and others focuses on things like the flows of voters. Mm. And actually, from a media point of view, that ought to be a lot more interesting than perhaps it is. Yeah. So when you get down below that first level of, you know, how people say they're going to vote, but how they voted last time and how they're planning to vote next time, you end up with actually some really interesting stories which are much more granular and potentially easier to write stories about than, oh, we're 2.1 here and, a, you know, 1 point up there kind of thing. So for me, you know, what would have been interesting would have been to have seen journalists going down to the southwest and finding people that voted for Nick Clegg in 2010 and were saying, I'm not voting for the Lib Dems, I'm voting for Cameron's Conservative Party, and finding out, well, why are they doing that? You know, that seems to most people like a counterintuitive thing. It's like, if you don't like the Lib Dems for going into coalition with the Tories, then... So what was it that they had? If he felt like they'd broken the promises, then that would be an interesting thing. That would be something which lots of people would have been interested in the answer to. Now, it may have been that the Tories knew that this was happening and were able to target messages particularly at that group, but I have no real sense of what the motivations for those people were in voting that way. I think lots of people would have been interested in that. Similarly, when we're talking about getting other data sources, an interesting question for me is, if Labour are neck and neck in the polls, but are piling up thousands of extra votes on 2010 in lots of key marginal seats, Nuneaton, Carlisle, Lincoln, those kind of places, how is that happening? What's happening to the Conservative canvass returns? What's happening to the UKIP vote? What's happening on the ground in those places, in those specific seats that actually matter? And being able to get hold of, I mean, I know that they're not going to get canvass returns, but there are various other ways that you could do that, integrating that kind of national picture with what's happening on the ground in terms of the campaign. Because actually I feel like there's, and I think lots of journalists complain about this as well, and it goes back to budgets. So, you know, there isn't as much budget to send journalists out onto places. It's much easier to have them in Westminster commenting on what MPs are saying rather than what's going on.
And a lot of constituency level polling. I mean, we've almost forgotten about that. You know, there was so much of it which was designed to, I mean, the guys at May 2015 had a fantastic website, which was absolutely brilliant. And we talked to Chris Sanratty, didn't we, earlier on in the year. I'm just looking back at what we've obviously done this year. And it was some fantastic work from really smart people. And then the tragedy of it, well, tragedy is a strong word in this context, frankly, but yeah, the tragedy of it, if you permit the word, is like, that was all that work was done based on, essentially, polling that was wrong. I mean, it's...
Yeah, and which, but then even then, there were interesting things in that. So I don't think any polls suggested that there were large numbers of 2010 Conservative to 2015 Labour switchers. Right, no. So the backbone of, if you like, you know, old school swingometer polling style analysis suggests that if you forget everything about UKIP, everything about the Lib Dems, you look at those, that key number, which is essentially how general elections were decided for 50 years, fundamentally, very little movement. Mm. Therefore, unlikely to be a dramatic movement in seats. You then lose Scotland if you're Labour, and suddenly the Conservatives are in striking distance of majority, and that's pretty much what happened. So forget everything else, just that narrow band of numbers, people ought to have been able to sort of say that's a significant story. You know, going out and finding people who had voted Labour in 2005 but then voted for Cameron and the Conservatives in 2010 and then said, I'm actually going to be voting for Cameron again, even though all of the things that you in the media think about me, I'm going to be voting Conservative because I think X. Those stories just didn't really happen because everybody was searching around for sort of people who were going to vote Labour in spite of Ed Miliband, and it's like, well, those people would bugger all of them.
I want to talk about Scotland a bit because, I mean, one of the things I was thinking about coming in was, you know, what are the big stories of this year? And, you know, we spoke to John Curtis a couple of times about Scotland, and also I spoke to Kate Devlin as well from the Herald. It seems to me that history is always a hard thing to predict, I suppose. When you,
it's a profound philosophical comment.
How people will judge history is a hard thing to predict. Blame the fuzzy head.
Don't cut that out.
That is a Christmas show. We're going to keep that in. I think when the historians look back at this sort of period of time, I suspect that the big story, depending on what happens with Brexit or no Brexit, will be Scotland. I mean, obviously the independence referendum happened in 2014, but we've seen the sort of implications of that this year, haven't we? And to be fair, that was something the pollsters called very, very early. You know, not only was it...
What, the wipe out in Scottish seats?
Yeah, I think the pollsters... Yeah, I mean,
yeah, they got it early. I mean, it was blindingly
obvious.
That's
why it was such a big issue in the election, I think, too, in the campaign. But, you know, if you look at it, not only was that a problem for the Labour Party in terms of mechanically losing 40 seats... It was a huge wedge issue. I think James Morris mentioned this on the podcast as well. That, you know, it sort of arrived maybe quite late in the campaign, I believe. I might be misquoting him, but you know, it was not only was it an issue in losing seats there, it was an issue in being a wedge issue in the England, as the English voters didn't like the idea of a weak Miliband being sort of bossed around by Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond. So that was obviously a huge story, and now as we look forward, it's not a story that's going away. I mean, all the polls would suggest that next year, I know we'll come to next year in a bit, that the SNP are going to go from strength to strength, and then there's a potential second referendum maybe. And there's obviously a big debate the SNP have got to have internally about when to call that, because I think the consensus is that you only get two shots at this, at least in this generation. I mean, what do people think about the future of Scotland? Because we talked about the flows of voters, and I guess what probably the most profound one was the Labour voters to the SNP in Scotland. And that, has that not just fundamentally altered British politics? Not only in terms of the independence question, but in just the Labour Party's future. You know, they had a heartland there, and, you know, there's all, we've talked about Jeremy Corbyn and your leadership a lot. I don't want to go into too much detail on that in this episode, but, you know, Labour's got a big problem there. You know, it wants to try and win those seats back. The chances of Labour ever getting 41 seats again in Scotland feel like that's never going to happen again. And therefore, you've either got to do one of two things. You've got to compensate for that in England, and that has ramifications for how you achieve it, or you've got to sell to the British public the idea that a Labour SNP, not coalition, but deal of some kind is okay and don't worry about it. And it just feels to me that actually, when we look longer term, with all the hubbub of the Westminster bubble and Westminster politics, that is the major change that's happened this year. What do people think, Matt? What's your thoughts on Scotland?
I agree with your take. I mean, I think what's happened since the two things are quite related. There's sort of like a dividing line, the 45-55. And so the way that sort of in the background of everything, because the people are essentially voting along those lines. I mean, there are some people who will vote for the SNP but are no's. But essentially what's happened is that whereas the SNP were getting those sorts of numbers in Holyrood elections and then got 45% in the referendum, now they've sort of managed to consolidate that and get an even higher number in a Westminster election. So the disparity between Holyrood and Westminster elections are sort of closed up. In terms of how that affects it going forward, yes, it's a huge problem for Labour, because I mean, Labour would need to win in order to win a majority without getting increasing seats in Scotland. I mean, they would just need to win in the sort of places where they didn't win in 1997. Or, you know, it's so. Yes, I mean, I think the way back for Labour probably goes via making a Labour SNP, you know, deal of some sort, more palatable elsewhere, or waiting for the Tories to become unpalatable.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think about that whole thing? It does seem to me that people were a bit in England were worried about the idea of Labour being propped up by the SNP. Is that a Ed Miliband problem, do you think? I mean, how do you, if we assume that the Labour Party has to deal with that issue one way or another to ever govern again in this country? I mean, I think it would be as bold as that.
I actually disagree with Matt on the, you know, unable to construct a majority, but I'm sort of like rigging the deck in my favour by suggesting that I think over the course of time, and by the time Labour Party is in position to, in a sense, be in power again, the West Lothian question would have been resolved in a slightly different way to the way it's been resolved now. So I think the reality is, you know, and the Tories have already started talking about this in terms of, you know, having a veto and all the rest of it, that if a Labour Party wants to, for instance, radically, you know, save, invert commas, or change, or whatever, invest, whatever word you want to do in the NHS, or wants to, you know, do something about education policy, it's going to need a majority in a Westminster Parliament. So actually, the reality is that, you know, the SNP, in a sense, the Scottish seats influence on the outcome of a British general election, on the policy issues that matter to the vast range of British people, for the vast majority of English voters,
is actually going to be quite limited, I think increasingly limited. I don't know exactly how it will pan out, but I think, I would advise, if I was in the position where anybody was listening to me, that Labour should focus on, in a sense, resolving its English issues rather than, in a sense, diverting its attentions to, oh, maybe we can do something that will re-engage Scottish voters. I think that needs to happen, but I don't think that anybody that wants to be in 10 Downing Street should, in a sense, devote too much attention to it. I think there's a real danger and a real risk there. Not least in terms of, you know, there's, you know, the evidence that people were saying, oh, well, Jeremy Corbyn will re-engage lots of Scottish voters. It's like, great, that's really helpful. But I think the more substantive point is, I think on the specifics of the election, the Nicola Sturgeon bossing Ed Miliband thing was more of a proof point about a perceived weakness in Ed Miliband's leadership than, in a sense, a grand strategic issue that people have with Scotland. One of the reasons why I think that is that if you know, maybe this is a London-centric perspective, but certainly when I was looking at focus groups in London, people are like, yeah, right, so, you know, the SNP's there, she's quite impressive or whatever, but fundamentally, I don't really care. Mm. Where it may have been an issue is more in the sort of Trans-Pennine corridor, where there are lots of seats and where, obviously, the Labour Party did less well, where, in fact, you know, people are more, if you like, resentful of the Barnett formula and the West Lothian question and all the rest of it, of feeling of a perceived sort of lack of voice. I think London residents are different in all sorts of ways, but one of the things is that, you know, they don't perceive such a big issue. They're like, yeah, we give lots of money to Scotland, but we give lots of money to everywhere else. I mean, it's a sort of classic Londoner rejoinder. Mm. Like, the issues of the constitution and the fiscal union are sort of much less present.
I do wonder whether we underestimate in this country, for whatever reason, and maybe it's our electoral system, I don't know, or whether it's just culturally, governments don't change that often in this country. I mean, like, I'm 31 and there's been two changes of government in my lifetime. I was born in a Tory government, 97 happened, 2010 happened, and I mean, I suppose you could argue that 2015 was a change of government in the regard that it was a coalition to a Conservative majority, but actually, you know, I sort of treat it as, well, the same person's running the government is David Cameron, and that's maybe we're just a risk-averse nation in terms of, you know, when it comes to an election, there will be a swing back towards the government. And part of the problem with the polling, I think, actually, is that it's hard to really know what exactly happened in terms of voters' minds. You know, were they made up a year ago, or was it the wedge issue of the SNP late on? We don't necessarily.
But to the point we were making earlier, I mean, the elections are fundamentally decided by a very small number of not particularly politically engaged people who, yeah, I think do move sort of, not exactly in a wave, but you certainly see this in the States and certainly in first past the post systems, that in a sense the momentum required for that wave usually goes beyond the kind of the defences which it's trying to breach. So hence you get 97, hence you get the 1994 wave in the midterms in the States, and then again in 2014 in the States, where, you know, something fundamentally shifts, and on relatively low turnouts, a small group of not particularly politically engaged people do change their mind. They're like, these guys have had 10 years or whatever it might be. It's time to, you know, this. You hear this in focus groups. It's time to give the other guys a go.
Yeah.
And so this question of, like, what oppositions can do is fundamental, because what you need to do as an opposition is be in a situation where you can credibly pick up that response, in a sense, that responsibility, when that group of not particularly politically engaged voters go, it's time to give the other side a go. Mm. Ooh, let's have a look at them. Maybe not.
Yeah. No.
But I think that kind of psychological approach to voting is the kind of thing that people need to look at. It's not like going into the supermarket and choosing washing powders, where you're sort of comparing them side by side all the time, or looking at the prices, and you have lots of other information. There's much more of a kind of, like, I'm not engaged, I'm not engaged, I'm not engaged. All right, maybe we'll have a look. Oh, yes, or oh, no. And so that's why, how you end up with a wave, but it's also how you end up with prolonged periods in power. So arguably that's what happened in 1992. Kinnock had 5 years to convince people that he was the man for the job, and there was a bunch of people who weren't particularly politically engaged who were like, no, I'm not. I'm going to stick with what we know. And similarly, you know, I think arguably it was Ed Miliband, but part of it is actually, you know, it's only been 5 years.
Yeah.
Let's give them another crack.
Mm, yeah, I think also I agree with all of that. But another thing that shouldn't be ignored is that since 1979, there's been a lot more economic stability than there has for most of the century. I mean, we've had wars, and then we've had in the 70s very high inflation. So there were reasons for, you know, either big things, or in, you know, in the case of economic instability, people getting upset with the government and wanting to change it. But yeah, I mean, we've had recessions and currency crisis, but we haven't
had the sort of very unstable economic conditions like we had in the 70s.
And of course the wave in 2010 was triggered by, you know, by exactly that, by an economic
Also, I mean, the thing about 2010, I mean, it didn't give the Conservatives a majority, but when you remember how far behind they were, they had less than 200 seats to start with. I mean, in terms of, if you look at it, changes rather than levels, in some ways it was a wave.
I want to move on to looking forward to the future. I mean, one of the things that researchers do a lot is look at sort of the trends. I want to talk a bit about immigration, actually, because it seems to be that there's an issue there with that rising in saliency here and also globally. But before we do that, I think you can't do a review of the year without talking about Jeremy Corbyn winning the leadership of the Labour Party. We've done that to death a bit on this podcast. I don't want to go rehash a lot of those arguments, but at the same time, it's a review of the year. It was quite a stunning thing that happened. I mean, as I said at the beginning of the show, if you'd said this time last year, Conservatives are going to win a majority and Jeremy Corbyn is going to be leader of the Labour Party, I think we'd have been like, that doesn't sound right. But I mean, to be fair, Matt, I give YouGov their props. I mean, they called this, didn't they? Given how difficult the election was for the pollsters, and I mean, particularly YouGov, I mean, let's be honest, they had a poll out every day that said it was neck and neck.
Yes.
I mean, we know the YouGov guys well. We greatly respect what they do, but that was a bad moment for them, wasn't it? And there was at one point there was a challenge around, you know, actually, is there a mode problem with the polls that could really threaten YouGov's raison d'etre, so to speak? But they've really pulled it out with that Jeremy Corbyn poll that showed him ahead, didn't they? And that was a difficult one to do with such a moving target of that audience.
Yeah, not only a moving target, but also it's worth reiterating what a non-standard audience that is. Mm. I mean, when you're polling the public of Great Britain is very different to polling the membership of a party, which even without the problem of the sort of the fluidity of it, has unknown characteristics.
And the union members.
And the union members. And affiliates. Yeah. And also it's just a very small number of people.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it's, I mean, it's and I mean, YouGov, because of the size of their panel, are actually able to get a representative sample of that in a way that...
And they know who in the past has said that they're a union member or said that they're a Labour Party member. Yeah. So they have a bit of an advantage. I agree. I think, you know, YouGov do deserve, real credit for that. But at the same time, it was such a big victory that what would have been really astonishing is if they hadn't have been able to say it. And I suspect when they did that original poll, they were like, is that right? Do we really say this? Whereas actually, you know, the size of the victory. I mean, and to the point about who are Labour Party members, I mean, lots of interesting stats coming out now of, you know, so tens of thousands of people have joined.
We talked about flows, didn't we?
So that's a huge thing in terms of, if you're thinking about, you know, if you were someone who was not necessarily a big fan of Corbyn's leadership, you know, and you're thinking about how to win the next leadership election, whenever that might be, or even if you are a fan of Jeremy Corbyn, but you think that there'll be another leadership election in, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, whatever it would be, you know, who that membership is astonishingly different. I mean, it genuinely is
a new party. Isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know,
it's the same brand, it's the same name,
and there's lots of, and let's face it, let's not overdo it. There are still lots and lots of people, and lots of the people that have left, one might expect might come back, and you know, there's a fair amount of fluidity going on both sides. But at the same point, it's very different. You know, tens of thousands of people moving from side to side. Also, I suspect what's interesting to me is the way in which that wave has sort of interacted with a Conservative policy agenda and the general news agenda in terms of. So, I think a lot of people, you know, in the party voted for Corbyn. Not necessarily in full endorsement of all of his views or of his particular set of people's views. Not all of them were supporters of the Labour Representation Committee or the Grassroots Alliance in elections and so on, but they wanted a sort of a clean break, a change, a wave. It was, in a sense, charm to give something different a go.
And bluntly, the other three candidates were not particularly impressive.
No, or certainly didn't necessarily articulate a particularly distinctive policy agenda, or their policy agenda was very much dictated by what they felt they needed to do, like, then and there, in order to fight the Conservative majority as they saw it. So they were sort of like fighting, in a sense, they were fighting the 2015 general election again rather than the 2020 general election or whatever. But I think the key thing for that is lots of those people don't necessarily fully agree with the foreign policy views, and it's been foreign policy which has been the primary thing that has been discussed in Parliament, in the nation, and has been the primary cleavage within the parliamentary Labour Party ever since. Lots of those Corbyn supporters don't necessarily agree with that. They're not pacifists or isolationists or fans of Russia's foreign policy or fans of terrorism or whatever else it might be that people might perceive Corbyn's leadership to have taken the party dangerously close to.
But they oppose Biden and they oppose Syria bombings of Syria, right? So,
well, not necessarily, I think. Well, maybe. But I think fundamentally what they do agree with and what lots of those people, even in the moderates, might do and what Corbyn would have, I don't know, ideally, I would have thought from his perspective, but also from the perspective of Labour moderates, is to unify the party around the things that they do agree on, which is renationalisation of the railways, also something pretty popular in the country as a whole.
I would argue superficial and popular.
Well, maybe, but, like, you know, there's a hell of a lot of middle-class AB commuters in the southeast that absolutely hate Southwest trains. I speak as one of them. But, like, you know, there are lots of issues around which you could build a kind of a popular left-of-centre vehicle which wouldn't be as divisive and as problematic. And I'm not in any way blaming Corbyn specifically for this, but the way in which the news agenda and Cameron and Osborne have played this has been quite helpful. Similarly, on the budget, so lots of the things which, you know, a kind of a left-of-centre majority, potentially quite populist grouping could have been, you know, opposing middle-class tax cuts, which is essentially opposing middle class, you know, social security with benefit withdrawal, which is effectively what the tax credit stuff is all about, you know, would have been something. But, you know, taking away lots of those pillars around which a kind of a reconfiguration under Corbyn's leadership might have happened on the centre left hasn't happened. So you've got Corbyn's won lots of those battles. The majority of the PLP voted with him on Syria. You know, lots and lots of people are joining the party. It is arguably a more supportive environment than even when he was elected. They won the Oldham by-election, so there wasn't that kind of complete acute crisis of we've lost one of our safe seats to UKIP, you know, what on earth's going on? But at the same time, none of the things around which I think, in a sense, he could unify the Labour Party have really offered themselves up. Mm. And so the party goes into the recess in quite a weak position.
It does feel to me, though, yeah, I would agree with that, but I think he goes into the recess in a very strong position, doesn't he? I mean, I think that, if you, as you mentioned, with the by-election, there was a very... It was an interesting result because it seemed to be everyone was assuming it was going to be a bad result for Labour, and in the fact that they increased the vote share, I know Dan Hodges tried to spin it as a kind of reduced majority in ways I still don't understand because the turnout was lower, so it's mechanically going to be a smaller majority in absolute
arguing
terms.
Arguing with Dan Hodges about absolute numbers versus relative numbers, like, I'd enjoy seeing that.
Well, I don't know, but that was obviously the expectation management game was in Corbyn's favour there, and as you've mentioned, the membership's changed and it's very much united behind him, so he's
But both sides, as we said on the day after it, both sides have got something to cheer in that, right? A moderate local candidate from a working class background who supported Liz Kendall, versus a national picture that, you know, and people on the doorstep saying, you know, don't like the look of. I mean, my favourite thing was the Vox Pop on the morning of the vote on the Today programme where they had women's just like, something not right about that Jeremy Corbyn. I can't do the accent. My apologies to all our listeners in the north, but the media narrative around it just got it all wrong in terms of, you know, what they were looking for and what actually happened.
But one of the things I'm curious about, I'm just hypothesising here, is whether Jeremy Corbyn might submit himself for re-election. There's a lot of debate about re-selections, isn't there? And, you know, Momentum and people like that are saying, oh no, there's going to be no re-selections, no, that's not on the table and all the rest of it. But then obviously there are going to be constituencies redrawn, which means that there's going to be re-selections of some kind in some places. And then that's going to be very interesting to see what happens and where and stuff. But if I was a leader of the Labour Party and I kind of wanted to have that democratic sort of, like, you know, pro-democracy kind of view of, you know, Labour MPs standing for re-selection, etc., what better way to make that happen than for me to stand myself, given that I'm reasonably confident with the makeup of the membership that I'm going to win. But then it feels to me now that I think there will be a challenge or a contest in this parliament, is my view. What I'm less sure about now, given that the left has solidified their control of the party, is whether that's going to be Corbyn just winning, just putting himself up and just winning, or whether there's going to be a Corbynista in the PLP, like a, I don't know, what's his name? Richard Burgeon, is it? He seems to be quite vocally supported.
Or Lisa Nandy's the other one that people
talk about. You know, or Clive Lewis, although that seems to... someone like that who, I mean, as you said, Rob, doesn't have the baggage, the Stop the War baggage, the IRA baggage, which, you know, I've said it many times, I think just makes Corbyn and McDonnell inevitable losers in a general election. Yeah. Doesn't matter. If you can't get out of the, you're not getting off the grid, to use a Formula One metaphor, if you're weak on defence. But some of these other people won't necessarily be, particularly people like Clive Lewis, who's served in the military, I believe.
Not sure the exact context there, but yeah, I think he served in the military. So it's kind of like, how can you, like with Dan Jarvis, how can you mock someone's credentials on defence or security when they've done that? But it, what do people think, Matt? I mean, we haven't brought you in for a little while. Yeah. I mean, obviously, this is just more of your opinion rather than looking at the polling. But I mean, what's your take on Labour and the future of Corbyn? It actually feels like he's had a relatively good 3 months of his leadership, however tumultuous it's been.
Yeah, I mean, he personally is in a much stronger position going into Christmas than a lot of people think. I mean, the Oldham by-election, I think, is a part of that, and the fact that in Syria, the Syria vote, I mean, he took a large majority of his party with him, and even a majority, I believe, of the shadow cabinet, a very small one, but a majority nevertheless. So he personally is in a good position. In terms of where Labour itself is, I mean, as you move away from the general election into the centre of a parliament, an opposition, you know, that is looking to do better at the next general election should be doing better by now in the polls. So, the indication on the basis of that is that it's that doesn't look likely, as you said. But, I mean, the interesting thing in terms of challenges to the leadership, for all the reasons that we talked about in terms of the composition of the membership, it seems as though, if Corbyn is on the ballot one way or another, or his, anointed successor, which, I mean, I think by all accounts, one way or another would be the case, that sort of challenge would be unlikely to succeed. At least in the near future. And also thinking about it technically, I mean, a lot of people thought about May after the local elections, the devolved elections and so on, as being a prime point in time for that. The problem, of course, is that the EU referendum might well be afterwards, maybe very shortly afterwards, and obviously the vast majority of the PLP are going to be very keen to get out on the doorsteps and win that referendum. So that makes that a difficult time.
And personally, I think Sadiq Khan's going to win the mayoralty in London. So, you know, now, again, Oldham, London, you know, these are places where you'd expect Labour to stack up votes and do well. But I still think that for Corbyn to be challenged from a moderate, and frankly, who that moderate would be and what their policy platform would be is not clear at all. I mean, I've written about this. I think, you know, there is the moderate wing, of which, you know, I am part of. I would, you know, not shocking to anybody, I think that I'm a critic of Corbyn, but it doesn't really have a lot to say about anything. I mean, it really doesn't. I mean, I think Chukra Muna and Jonathan Reynolds coming out the other day about the electoral system. It's like, well, your issue isn't about counting the votes; it's about how you win more.
That was part one of our two parts of end of 2015 special, looking back at the at 2015 and some of the key events there. The second half of the podcast, which we'll put up in a couple of days' time, looks at 2016 and specifically around the US presidential election, the EU referendum, and there may be some predictions about some other things that we're looking out for in what promises to be a very eventful year. As well, I think looking back there, it's certainly clear that the polls, in my view, did have an impact on the nature of the general election campaign, and the fact that the one of the key issues that was constantly discussed was the prospect of a deal between Labour and the SNP, and that does seem to have impacted some English voters in their mindset as they decided who to vote for in May. Although, having said that, I think that even though the polls were fundamentally wrong in terms of the spread between Labour and the Conservatives, it's actually, you know, the SNP issue was correctly called. So maybe it was legitimate that the Labour SNP deal or no deal sort of aspect of the election campaign was sort of widely scrutinised. I do think, though, that, you know, when historians look back at this time, that, you know, Scotland looks like, and the realignment of Scottish politics looks like the big seismic shift that we'll be talking about when we look back at 2015. And certainly Labour is a changed party too, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, how that plays out in the long term future. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn certainly feels strong in his position as the Labour leader at the moment, but I remain as convinced as ever that he would have no chance of winning a general election on the basis of some of the concerns over security. Now, I suppose, you know, you could caveat that with it depends on who the Tory leader is, but whoever that Tory leader is going to be the Prime Minister, so immediately has that kind of I would suggest a degree of incumbency bonus, maybe not as strong as David Cameron's, but certainly it will be there. But I think it might be interesting to see if Corbyn did stand down and hand over to, you know, a sort of Corbynista, if you like, who maybe doesn't have a lot of the baggage. And I think then the Tories would have something to maybe think about, although, you know, it would then still depend, I think, a lot of policy issues around defence and around spending and so forth. But, you know, that's an interesting debate that the sort of Corbyn left has to have with itself, because ultimately, you know, if he does stand down with a view of handing over to somebody else on his side of the party, you know, he obviously risks the moderates actually getting their act together and, you know, picking someone that ultimately wins the day. It's not clear who that person would be, but it's certainly possible. So, you know, maybe Jeremy Corbyn will try and hang on, because ultimately he can't be sure that if he tries to hand over the reins that he'll do so to someone that he would actually like successfully. But anyway, that was part one of this two-part special, as I say. Part two is me, Matt and Rob looking forward to the 2016 presidential election, and also the nature of the EU referendum and what the different campaigns there have to do to win or lose, and the importance, frankly, of David Cameron and this whole debate. But that will be up in the next few days. Thanks for listening. Anyone on iTunes, if you subscribe, do sort of leave a review or you know, rating, hopefully positive ones. Thanks to the people that already have done so. It really does help our ranking on iTunes and helps get us exposed to more people, so that's really helpful. But you know, thanks to all our listeners for listening in the last year. It's been really fun, and hopefully you've enjoyed listening to what we've had to say, whether you agree or disagree. Hopefully it's been informative, and you know, let me take this opportunity, if it's not too corny, to offer our listeners a very happy Christmas, and we'll be back in about a week's time, I think, with part two of the end of year review. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under a Creative Commons.